Hi, today we're going to talk about early menopause and POI, premature ovarian insufficiency. Hi, I'm Dr. Valerie Davidson from Progress Your Health.
And I'm Dr. Mackey from Progress Your Health. So today we have a question from Samantha. If you go to our website, progressyourhealth.com, you go to the top of the website, there's a tab there that says Ask the Doctor. Click the tab, enter your name and email. Write your question. That's where this question has come from. So we just did an episode and it'll be somewhere up there maybe about how to treat premature ovarian insufficiency. This one is sort of like a follow-up to that, not from the same person, but something that I thought was interesting to talk about.
All right. So I'm going to go ahead and read the question from Samantha. We do change everybody's names for privacy. But let's see, here we go. Question. I am 36 and have been slowly noticing perimenopause, low estrogen symptoms for the past year and a half. I went to an online provider and started HRT to have experienced so much relief. From mental symptoms to night sweats to dryness everywhere, I have started to feel so much better being on estradiol and progesterone for 3 months. I've been working with a functional nutritionist on my diet, walking daily, etc. I had gestational diabetes for all three pregnancies, and I also got my tubes tied or removed last year. So when I came off of birth control, all of my symptoms started. I recently saw my normal OBGYN so that I could get my HRT through insurance, and he agreed, but made it clear this isn't menopause. It could be POI, premature ovarian insufficiency. But that seemed skeptical. I got my blood work done and my FSH has risen in the past few months from 3.7 to 8, but it is still considered normal. All my thyroid and other blood work also comes back normal. Is this POI a possible diagnosis? I feel crazy.
Well, what do you think about this one? We did one recently. Someone had mentioned that they've had a confirmed diagnosis of POI, which is not really all that common necessarily, pretty rare to actually have full-blown premature ovarian insufficiency. There's a couple of key things that she mentions in here. So what are your thoughts?
Well, POI or premature ovarian insufficiency is where the ovaries have started to decline and cease making hormones much earlier than would be the anticipated age of menopause. So like the median age of menopause or the average age of menopause is 51 and a half. So for Samantha to be going through menopause at 36, that's awfully early that the conclusion could be assumed that the ovaries are just, you know, ceasing in their function, which would be considered that early premature ovarian failure or premature ovarian insufficiency. So that's one thing that I notice here. But what I think this question really sort of talks about is she's going by, you know, she started some HRT, some estradiol, estrogen, and some progesterone for 3 months and felt amazing. But she started that based on her symptoms because she was saying she was having perimenopause, low estrogen symptoms, went on this HRT, felt great, went to see her general OBGYN, which then ran some blood work. So I think the main part about this question is perimenopause, and we've done this before, can you take hormones, estrogen in perimenopause? Can you do hormone replacement in perimenopause? What is the difference between whether Samantha is in perimenopause or menopause? And I really don't think she has ovarian failure, but I can see where her doctor would be skeptical on, you're not in menopause, you probably aren't in premature ovarian failure. So what's going on with these hormones and the hormones that she's taking?
Yeah, sure. This is also sort of similar. We did one on POI. We did one, when is perimenopause ending? This is where it sort of gets, now granted, just based on age alone, right? 36, probably not menopause quite yet, right? And honestly, even that with an FSH level of, what did she say, went from 3.7 to 8. That tells you right there that it's not POI or menopause at that point.
Exactly. So an FSH is a follicle stimulating hormone. So it stands for follicle stimulating hormone. It's not actually a hormone. We used to call them releasing factors back in the 90s, but now they changed it to stimulating hormones. It's a signal that comes from the brain, the pituitary, and monitors overall ovarian function. So someone going through true menopause, when their ovaries start to decline in function, you'll see that FSH number rise. So when you see somebody and when you look at these reference ranges on these labs, they're all kind of ridiculous. So, but when you see somebody that might be around 25 to 45, that's kind of pointing towards perimenopause, maybe in the high teens, But anybody that is under 10 is usually showing pretty good ovarian function. And the FSH does change through someone's cycle. So she's mentioning she was on birth control pills, so she must be having some kind of cycle or a period, not mentioning that. But in a perfect 28-day cycle, your FSH will change throughout that time because it is trying to stimulate the ovaries to make estrogen. So I would say it going from 3.7 to 8 isn't really a big change.
Yeah, no, that could just be where she took one blood test in the month versus the second blood test in the month. It could change that little bit. Both numbers are under 10. Mm-hmm. So that tells you that the brain and the ovaries are still communicating properly. Now, what impact do you think being on the birth control pills contributed to her symptoms? Now that she's off birth control for a while, this is, I think, a little misconception about birth control too. A lot of women think, or even some doctors think, that birth control pills basically tells your body that you're pregnant. Okay? It sort of does the opposite. It sort of suppresses the cycling of the hormones so you don't ovulate. It doesn't necessarily tell you that you're pregnant necessarily. So by her taking birth control, she didn't say what kind of birth control she took. She's actually putting herself in a pseudomenopause, right? That's sort of what birth control pills do. Now she's off birth control, having all these symptoms. Do you think that's going to potentially, being on estrogen, is going to sort of catch up with her at some point?
I think it probably will. Like you said about birth control pills, a lot of them can be where they have, you know, the first week or, you know, part of that birth control pill might have the synthetic estrogen, and then you have the synthetic progestin with the estrogen in there to keep that lining thin. And then you take the sugar pills, which are basically placebo, and then you have a period. So there is some hormones, you know, with birth control, they're just synthetic. And whenever I've done a FSH, a follicle stimulating hormone, on a woman that was on birth control pills, maybe because inadvertently didn't know she was on birth control pills or that just happened, their FSH is usually very suppressed, showing that the brain is picking up some kind of estrogen or that progestin in the system, so it suppresses that FSH. And then when you take somebody off of birth control pills, those ovaries, which had basically been in hibernation because they're on those synthetic hormones to stop ovarian function, basically to stop ovulation, to cause, you know, not have babies, get pregnant, is when you take them off of the birth control, those ovaries have to wake up again. And you will see, you know, a lot of times I will see symptoms of women when they come off of birth control, especially more, I would say, in the early 40s, because, you know, a woman in her mid 40s should not be taking birth control pills, and probably not even in the late 30s, but that's a whole nother topic in itself. But I would say probably it took a little while for her ovaries to kind of wake up. But I'm wondering, because she is only 36, she's not on birth control. We don't know how much estradiol she's on. We don't know how much progesterone that she's on. I do feel like that FSH number probably is more accurate for her, not based on the hormones that she's taking. So I would say that she definitely isn't menopausal. I would say she's definitely doesn't have ovarian failure or ovarian insufficiency. I would almost put her in more of like a perimenopause.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, just based on age alone, 36, you know, she's had 3 babies, so progesterone levels are going to be affected by the more children you have. Sort of, you know, the rebound response after those babies isn't going to be necessarily the same once she's not pregnant anymore. So perimenopause symptoms in the late 30s is very common, mm-hmm. right? A lot of women, I was just talking about a woman, or I think we might have discussed it on one of the last episodes, a woman that a lot of her symptoms, she is having some really major depressive issues, and it all happened she's about 38 at the time. So in her late 30s, we assumed after the fact, because hormones have been very helpful for her from a mood standpoint, that her symptoms really got significantly worse. She had a child at 33. Her symptoms really got worse. Her mood really sort of tanked, like major depressive disorder in her late 30s, kind of like right where Samantha is. So I agree. I don't think that it's POI. I don't think it's menopause. I think that it's a combination of where she is, 3 babies, approaching 40, not 40 quite yet, mm-hmm. and the fact that she's on the birth control pills for a little while. I mean, do you agree? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I definitely think that is part of it. I think she's probably feeling really good because she's taking the progesterone. You know, a woman mm-hmm. in perimenopause taking progesterone, they love it. I'm not sure about the estradiol or what dose it is. It could be a very, very low dose because she did see an online provider that provided the HRT, so they must have taken some kind of intake. I'm not, it doesn't look like maybe there was any blood work drawn, but there must have been some intake maybe on the symptoms. So maybe that little bit of estradiol probably also helped because she was might have been tanking a little bit because she'd come off the birth control pills.
So what you mean there, her ovaries, her own estrogen production hasn't really quite picked up yet.
Possibly, or just like when women do come off of birth control pills, there is kind of a, you know, a huge change in the system. Some women don't even get a period for months and months. Some women get a period, two periods in a month after coming off of birth control. So it's really trying to get that cycle going again. A lot of women that don't have a, or they have an IUD, when they have the IUD removed, they'll have a huge tank in progesterone. So I always have to bridge when they have the IUD out with some progesterone so they don't feel terrible. Yeah. So, you know, I do think that that's probably an issue with it. It would be more where I could see the OBGYN not really sure what to do because you don't really want to give a woman that's not in menopause estradiol because you don't want, especially if she obviously has a uterus, is that can, as we've talked about before, is too much estradiol and not cycling it, doing a static dose on a premenopausal female could cause that uterine lining to get too thick, could cause irregular bleeding, and could even be a risk factor for uterine cancer.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of like, you know, what we've talked about a lot with perimenopause, especially on the last episode, is when is the woman really an estrogen candidate? Yeah. Okay, right now, based on age alone, she's probably not. Now, she feels really good. Estrogen is what makes a woman a woman. The more of it she has, the better she feels. So if her ovaries have been a little dormant because of the birth control, she didn't say how long she's been on birth control, right? The longer she's been on it, you would assume the more dormant the ovaries are or would be. So it's probably taken a while for them to sort of wake back up a little bit. What about, you know, estradiol? So we're maybe assuming the patch probably. Would you assume a patch?
I don't know. You know, I'm not sure. I would think if she went on the patch, she would feel terrible because a woman that isn't in menopause, putting on that an estradiol patch can be pretty strong and cause a lot of water weight, can cause a little weight gain, some puffiness, breast tenderness, really moody. That I'm imagining it's probably an estradiol transdermal that she might put on like the inner thigh, something like that. Mm-hmm. And it's probably a low dose because if she's using, you know, one of those online providers that, you know, I would imagine they're probably really careful at going, let's go low and then work your way up. Yeah. You know,
which just, is something that we've seen across the board is that everyone is, especially because of her age, is choosing a low dose anyways, but even more so because she's only 36.
Yeah, 36. So like on the other podcasts we've done, I think it was maybe the one before this one, we talked about, you know, being in that gray area or that in-between land where you're not quite in menopause, but you're also just coming out of perimenopause, that a lot of those women, you know, and I myself am in that area, can feel really crummy and would love to and probably would do really well with a little bit of estrogen, but it needs to be, you know, really balanced, really, you know, monitored, and then just making sure it's not causing any strife in the uterus.
Yeah. Well, she hasn't had any bleeding for 3 months, you know, as she says, but
it doesn't say if she had any bleeding.
She's been on it for 3 months. Assuming she feels amazing, been on it for 3 months with no bleed. We are assuming no bleeding because she doesn't mention that. You know, it may take, you know, 3 months in a day. It may take 4 months. It may take 5 or 6 months. But more than likely, if we had to bet on this, that eventually the estradiol she's using could potentially sort of mess up her own cycle.
It might, like you said earlier at the beginning of the podcast, it could catch up with her, right? It could eventually cause a little thickening, irregular periods, a little water weight, you know, feeling kind of moody. So it could eventually catch up. I do think she did two blood works with the FSH, the 3.7 and the 8, is I would continue to probably test that FSH number, then possibly test that estradiol and that progesterone, depending on where she is in her cycle, to see, you know, what type of candidate she would be for how much progesterone would be good for her, or even if she were a candidate to do a little bit of estradiol. Because I do feel like, just circling back to what she had mentioned about having the gestational diabetes.
Right.
So what do you think about her having the gestational diabetes with all three of her pregnancies?
Well, I mean, that tells us a little bit about blood sugar control, you know, insulin status potentially, right? Now, one thing I don't necessarily agree with in gestational diabetes as a quote-unquote diagnosis, they just look at blood sugar. Right? They don't look at insulin. That's why with our patients, we usually screen that pretty much on everyone. Now, granted, if it comes back normal the first time, or if they have, you know, good lifestyle things, I'll check out. You know, you check it once. If it's a nice low number, you want an insulin level somewhere, ideally less than 10. In a perfect world, less than 5 on a fasting insulin. You know, we see lots of numbers, and, you know, some have really great numbers and some not so much. So we could assume with three pregnancies with gestational diabetes that they're, you know, there's probably some of that metabolic dysfunction going on. I think our next episode, we're going to probably talk a little bit more, not about the gestational diabetes, but more about that metabolic dysfunction stuff.
That's what I was thinking, is a little bit of that metabolic, because all the hormones connect together. It's not like, you know, this hormone does this and it has not influenced by this one. That I'm wondering if maybe she could be a little bit insulin resistant. Working on that is also why she felt so good with that estrogen and that progesterone.
Well, I mean, you even said yourself, you were kind of dabbling with a little bit of bias recently, and you felt great, but then you got
bleeding.
Yeah, you started bleeding right away. You know, so more than likely, like you said, in this case, it's probably going to catch up with her at some point. Now, short term, she felt really good. That's okay.
That's what I was thinking, is maybe it was helping balance, you know, the insulin, her cortisol. She might have some, you know, irregular cortisol issues going on along with that insulin and that estrogen, especially progesterone, which can help, you know, balance cortisol, raise up the GABA. But you're right. I do think that estradiol probably will catch up with her at some point, like it caught up with me. It's so weird to be on the other side of the coin, because I've always treated menopausal women, you know, for 20 years. And here I am kind of going through it and understanding that. So it's different too. Like, I have a patient that comes up and, you know, we do the blood work, we take the symptoms, I come up with a good treatment plan. But when I'm thinking about myself, it's like a blank.
Well, that's why you need an objective person, right?
True.
An outside observer, someone that's looking at yourself, as opposed to, you know, we can't evaluate ourselves that well. We have sort of a blind spot for ourselves, knowing, you know, how do we approach this? You know, we talked about this many times. I don't think, we've talked about rhythmic dosing. I don't think you're a candidate for that quite yet. Because I think right now for you, just because your cycle is so close to finishing and it's still being a little sporadic, giving you rhythmic dosing right now would just, like you said earlier, just make you feel terrible. It'd be too much. You'd feel puffy. You probably gain a little bit of, you know, some water weight. Your boobs would probably get all, you know, tender and sore.
Everybody's an individual. That's why it's interesting about Samantha is, you know, I know my whole life I've always been very estrogen sensitive. She could be somebody that's not really sensitive to that.
But she's got three kids though.
I know. Yeah.
She got three kids. She doesn't have PCOS per se because she got three kids. But she's had gestational diabetes. So like I said, there's just some things there. That's why these questions are fun, because we get to sort of make some assumptions and sort of do some detective work, but there's also some information that's missing that we would, you know, if we're talking to the person as a patient, we'd be able to fill in some of those gaps a lot easier.
But the questions are great because they're real. You know, when you're looking at somebody, there's so much minutia to their life to pull in to, you know, finding the right treatment plan for them. So I do think with Samantha, seeing the functional nutritionist is really great. And then she's doing the walking. In some ways, after coming off of the birth control pills, it's not just jump into some estrogen. Maybe it is kind of working on that metabolic health, working on your diet, working on the lifestyle. There's lots of supplements you can take and different nutritional supplements that she could work with that could probably help with the ovaries.
Yeah.
So, but I do think the progesterone, in her late 30s, she's probably really loving that progesterone.
Yeah, progesterone is the thing that she could, you know, she could easily maintain. But if she starts bleeding irregularly, you know, the estrogen sort of has to just be stopped. You can't. That's the part that makes perimenopause for it. They have all of the symptoms. Not all of them, but majority of the menopausal symptoms, but because they're menstruating on their own still, they're just not really a candidate. And there's no real way, unless it's like an extremely low dose, or if you're using it locally, either on the face or for vaginal dryness issues or, you know, pain with intercourse, you can get a woman can get away with something like that.
You mean the estriol vaginally?
Estriol. They can get away with something like that as a little bit of estrogen, but using it as a systemic approach is, you know, most of the time is just going to cause some problems.
Yeah, eventually. So I would say, you know, for Samantha, doing maybe a little bit more blood work to check into the hormones again, because she only has two FSH, to do with estradiol, do the progesterone, do your testosterone, check your cortisol, check your DHEA sulfate. So maybe doing a more comprehensive profile, and then also keep working with that functional nutritionist, because obviously having that gestational diabetes, that there's probably a little bit of some metabolic work that needs to be happening for her. But I think estriol on a perimenopausal woman is just fine. But that little phase between perimenopause, just going into menopause, can be months. It could be a year. Nobody wants to feel crummy. So I think she would just need to work with a little more closely with a practitioner that would be open to working with a little estrogen with her, but keep doing a transvaginal ultrasound, keeping track of your periods, keeping track of the blood work, having that relationship there, I think would really probably benefit
now,
for her.
Let's just say hypothetically for a minute. So she mentioned for her previous two blood tests, FSH was 3.7 and 8, mm-hmm. relatively the same numbers, right? They're both below 10. It's going to fluctuate, depending on the day, depending on the month. If you did it the same day of your cycle, month after month, it's still going to be a different number, mm-hmm. right? The number is not going to stay static all the time because those hormones literally from day one to a period to day 12. So the first 12 days, there's a significant increase in estrogen over that period of time. So hypothetically, let's say she was approaching menopause, mm-hmm. Early menopause, that's what we're really deciding here. Early menopause or POI, mm-hmm. okay? POI, it's like something you never really hear of, and all of a sudden now we hear about it all the time these days, right? Premature ovarian insufficiency. So what would you expect to see if either of those were a potential in this situation?
Well, definitely the increase in the FSH. So if, let's say she did another blood draw in a few months and her FSH was like 18 or 28, then, okay, we're looking at something mm-hmm. happening here. The hormones are definitely dropping. But then at the same time, with the POI, I would say, that those numbers would be off. With POI, women don't have periods, because they're not making any estrogen to cause that lining of the uterus.
Right, right.
When I remember back in, this must have been 20 years ago, I had a woman that we possibly thought had POI, or we called it premature ovarian failure.
She was
28. She was young. Okay. She was young. So we did a progesterone challenge where you give her, about 100 to 200 milligrams of progesterone. You take that for a week and then you stop. And if they start bleeding within that week or during that time of taking the progesterone, mm-hmm. that means that they aren't going through ovarian failure, because that's what we called it then, our ovarian insufficiency now. So that would be something. But if she's having a period every month, that wouldn't be.
Well, we don't know if she
we
is.
Don't, yeah, we don't. We, yeah, we don't
she's
know.
She's on the birth control.
But if she were, then that really wouldn't be a POI, or even checking the levels. Let's say she's not taking any hormones.
And even with POI though, or menopause, wouldn't her FSH be closer to 100? Like if she was really going through POI, she'd have no period, and her FSH would be a significant clue, because it'd be like 75 to 100, wouldn't it be?
If it was actually POI. If it's coming, primarily from the ovaries just shutting off.
Right.
Just shutting off. So I would say POI is not that common, even though we have heard about it more. It really isn't. That I would say Samantha probably is in perimenopause, and it is hard to differentiate between the two. And when you're in perimenopause, some women do feel good on a little bit of estrogen.
Oh, yeah.
You just have to be careful with it. Someone like me, like I said, I felt great when I took that biased for a little bit, but then I didn't.
You felt fine overall, but mm-hmm. it was just that your bleeding, your cycle just got a little messed up, which is what's going to happen every
single
time.
Well, I hadn't had a cycle for a while and then it came back. So I'm in like that gray area, the in-between time.
Right.
So, possibly Samantha is too at 36. I've had women that have gone into menopause in their early 40s, and that's okay. That's nature's way. You're following nature, but at the same time, you're thinking if somebody, let's say Samantha truly was going into menopause or had POI, you got to think about it, 36, what are her bones going to be like when she's 56? Thinking about her heart, the estrogen is so good for the heart. It's so good for the brain. It's obviously good for her symptoms here acutely, but mm-hmm. if somebody truly were going through an earlier menopause or a POI, we'd want to consider some of the long-term effects that could have on someone.
Sure. Yeah. Cause I mean, she's right now, just statistically, she's what, almost 15 years early from, 51, kind of right where you are, the average onset of menopause, she's quite a bit early, but again, those labs just don't really, make a lot of sense that, she's in, menopause or POI. And age-wise, certainly in the late 30s, that is when those perimenopausal symptoms are going to start showing up pretty much across the board. Certainly, it seems like for a lot of women, if they're trugging along just fine, they hit 40, it's like their 40th birthday, and all of a sudden now things started to go a little haywire, a little sideways. But, you know, we've seen it. When would you say, you know, the earliest you have seen, you know, actual perimenopausal symptoms? That, how would you differentiate between perimenopausal symptoms and PMS?
Well, perimenopausal symptoms happen all month long. You know, yeah. PMS, 4 days, 7 days, maybe they're ideally not supposed to be super intense. You know?
Right.
Ideally, it's like, okay, I wanted a little chocolate and I felt a little weepy, but it wasn't anything and, you know, extreme.
Nothing too extreme.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly. So, you know, that's where the perimenopausal symptoms, you have that all month, the carb cravings, terrible time sleeping, irritability. Like I always said on other podcasts, if you want to just say classic, simple perimenopause is irritability and, you know, kind of feeling angry, not really warranted for the situation, and waking up in the middle of the night, not being able to go back to sleep.
Right.
Where menopause, it's the hot flashes and the night sweats that are keeping you up, but you don't see that as much irritability like you see in a perimenopausal female. More right. like worry, nostalgia, maybe even a little more on the sad side because that estrogen has dropped yeah. down. So, but I do feel like perimenopause is underserved population of women.
Well, I mean, that's why, you know, that's sort of why we're talking about this, because women go from having PMS issues to perimenopausal issues to menopausal issues. It's like, you know, women in their whole reproductive lives don't really get much of a break. They're always sort of dealing with something. And maybe because it's our practice and that's the type of women we deal with. Some, I will say there's a percentage that have really smooth, easy periods, right? For the most part, or they have a history of having, you know, so no PMS, and usually they actually transition between a perimenopause and menopause actually fairly well. But it seems like the ones that have, and this is not a hard and fast rule, but it seems the ones that have the worst their PMS and they transition worse through those other two phases, at least, you know, it sort of seems that way anyways.
Yeah, you have lots of years experience to kind of be able to see that correlation.
Yeah. Yeah. Anything else to say about Samantha? So we are just assuming that it's just full blown perimenopause. The estradiol probably will catch up with her at some point. At least she feels better than she did once she's been off the birth control. Anything else to add about this one?
I would say with this one, do some more blood work, find out mm-hmm. if it's truly POI. I would be skeptical too. I don't think it is. It really doesn't look that way. It doesn't really look like early menopause either. She could easily stay on that progesterone and probably feel really good while working with her nutritionist and doing the lifestyle and the dietary and probably some nutritional supplements along with that she probably doesn't even really need the estradiol.
Right. Well, like I said, she feels amazing, but it's a matter of feeling good with it. And it's starting to cause some complications and she's no longer a candidate.
And is it the progesterone? I know she had mentioned here just real quick. So sorry to keep going, but you know, she had mentioned about the night sweats. Is in perimenopause, it's very common to have night sweats, but you usually have them anywhere between 7 to 14 days before your period in perimenopause. Cause that progesterone didn't come up as much and that estrogen starting to decline, you know, so night sweats are pretty common, you know, being dry. I mean, I was telling someone this must've been when we moved to Washington, cause we used to live in Las Vegas, the Southwest. It's very dry. When I moved to Washington, it was, you know, there's so much humidity here that I was telling someone, between that and the progesterone is like an unsung hero for your hair and for your skin and mm-hmm. for that moisture. So I would say perhaps she's having some low estrogen symptoms, but you don't know unless you test it. You know, I do like the subjective information coming from someone, but actually testing it, like checking her estrogen level when she's not on her period, because when you're on your period, your estrogen's low.
So we're just obviously, we're just going. So we're going to cut it off and now we'll just keep going. We can't help it. So what would be we've talked about this before, but what's the best day for a situation like this? You're not really sure what's going on, sort of have some ideas. What's the best day for her to go get tested?
I would say for Samantha to get tested, if she's having a regular period, is to test her on day 21, because that'll tell you when that progesterone, because we don't make progesterone until you ovulate. And then once you ovulate, then you really make those higher levels of progesterone. So checking after ovulation, which day 21 is kind of like that perfect number, or even a little bit early in her cycle, if we're just looking straight at the estrogen, is looking at it as maybe day 12, because like you had mentioned, that's when that estrogen spikes is on day 12. Progesterone day 21, that's in a perfect 28-day cycle. I would never check her hormones, which I don't know if doctors still do this, but I remember like 20 years ago, it was really popular to do the hormones on day two.
On day two.
Yeah. Okay. I think they wanted to get a clear FSH because it does move around throughout the month.
Right.
But you can't check an estradiol on your period on day two, because that's what causes your period, is the estrogen and the progesterone all decline, which then causes, if there's no pregnancy or fertilization, mm-hmm. causes the, you know, the inside of the endometrium, or the endometrial lining inside the uterus, to slough off, and hence you have a period. So if you check your estrogen on day two, it's going to be low, which I've had stories like you, or patients have come in and said, oh, my doctor says I'm in menopause. And I'm like, no, you're not. You check your blood work when you're on your period, right?
Yeah. That does happen. But see, this is the thing too. They don't really start checking a woman's hormones, at least in our opinion anyways, early enough. And why don't they look at hormones when a woman's in her 20s or teens, 20s, as she's starting her menstrual history? So that way, let's say if it was primary care doing that, now there's a trend to see where those numbers are, especially if you're doing it on a particular time every month. That really is never done. I know you do it. We both do it, but that's not done conventionally. It's just like, oh, your hormones fluctuate. There's no reason for testing. But you know, on a day 12, like you're talking about, that estradiol level can fluctuate. One woman will have a level of 200 or 150, and another woman will have a level of 700, right? There's so much variance on that day 12 from woman to woman. I'm just curious as to, maybe we sort of have some ideas why it's not done that way, but I think it should be done that way.
Yeah. I mean, I have patients that I have their lab work and their hormonal profile when they were younger, in their 20s. And then we can see as they get older, as things change, you know, what is their hormonal profile? Because some women, like I said, make more estrogen. Mm-hmm. Some women make more progesterone. Some women make more androgens. It doesn't mean that they're polycystic ovarian syndrome or PCOS, because they have higher than normal testosterone and DHEA. That's just what makes them.
Yeah.
So it's nice to have that profile. But of course, you know, in medicine, they're not looking down the road. They're looking like, if you broke your leg right now, or I'm sick,
that's
or
true.
I have a strep throat, you know, they want to help you acutely.
I'm sure insurance won't pay for it or something, because there's no real medical necessity to do it, you know, because mm-hmm. nothing is wrong per se. But we still think looking at it ahead of time, you know, or before there's hormonal changes, inevitable hormonal changes for a woman. That way you sort of know where their baseline is, where they felt the best, where they feel the worst. It gives the practitioner and the woman herself, it gives a lot of information as far as, you know, what her own body is actually doing.
Absolutely. So did that answer it for Samantha?
I think so. Right. Well, we're going to wrap it up. Then we got back into a conversation. So I think we've kind of covered it. We think Samantha's just in perimenopause. It's not early menopause. It's not POI. FSH tells you a lot of that. So any further comments? Are we good for now?
I think we're good.
Okay. Until next time, I'm Dr. Mackey.
And I'm Dr. Davidson.
Take care. Bye-bye.